I'm Ernie.
I'm happy to introduce our speaker tonight, one of our own, Roger.
Keep going, would you? I'm Roger. And this is my home group. And I was wondering how to start. And some of the guys in here know me as the guy who looks stuff up in the dictionary. So I looked up home in the dictionary. A place where family lives. A place where one was born and raised. A place where one likes to be, restful and congenial. A place for the care of orphans, the blind, old, and helpless. A place where you or it belongs. A place where one likes to be, the center of affection, the center of the matter, to impress or make clear to someone beyond doubt. Effective, forceful, and to the point. Comfortable at ease, and willing to receive visitors. And that's this meeting. And ladies, if you could see how fast it takes us to go through the commitments in this meeting, it takes about 5 minutes to go through all those commitments. So this is a great meeting, and this is where I was raised. This is where my family lives, and this is where I got to grow up. I've been coming here about 5 years. I've been in Al-Anon 8 years. And 8 years and 1 month or so. Took a birthday last month. When I first came to Al-Anon, I came because my wife drank too much wine, took too much Vicodin, and spent too much money. And there was no fun in my life at all. I was completely miserable. So when my first Al-Anon meeting, I couldn't believe people were having fun. I couldn't believe people were laughing, and I couldn't believe I'd sunk so low as to have to hang out with a bunch of losers. You know, that was the worst part, actually. Was, you know, that I'd gotten that bad, and that it had come to this. But you know, therapy didn't work. We went once a week, and we would just scratch the teeniest little part of the butt of this huge monster we were dealing with, and it seemed like way too long before we were going to go back again and deal with this problem. We never got anywhere. And but when I came, I started hearing the sharing, and I started hearing people talking about that they'd had a lot of alcoholics in their lives and how alcoholism had affected their life. And I wondered how that happened. My sponsor is big on the history of AA and Al-Anon, and so he's gotten me reading a lot of semi-outside literature. And there's something in that outside literature about the beginning of how Al-Anons are created, and it talks about the disease of alcoholism putting us in unnatural situations. And in the example in the book, it talks about an alcoholic man who's married to a woman who is forced to become the mother of an erring boy. And if that woman has a predilection for mothering, then there's going to be a lot of undoing required. And that's no joke, because that's what I'm doing here. It's taking me the rest of my life to undo the power of that. What Chris said about the nuclear explosion of alcoholism in the house, you know. Mine was different. Mine was like a, germ warfare. You know, it just slowly snuck in and got everybody crazy. And I'm not blaming the alcoholic. You know, I'm really grateful too that I got here. I wish it hadn't had to happen this way. It was too damn much work. But I wouldn't have come here otherwise. I really came here completely destroyed. So I realized that my grandfather was, I think he was an alcoholic. I was the only person in the world he loved. He had treated my dad horribly, and I was his only grandson. But I do remember being in the hallway of their home in Salt Lake City, and him opening the cupboard, over the pantry and pulling out a bottle of, actually, I think it was Wild Turkey. That's kind of an Al-Anon moment for like a four-year-old. And he took a big drink of it and looked at me and said, "Don't tell your grandmother." And he never talked to me that way. And I remember thinking, what? But I realize now that he was sneaking it. He was hiding his drinking. And he raised my dad. My dad quit drinking the day his doctor told him to quit drinking. So I don't think he was an alcoholic. But he was a rough character. He's a real smart guy. But he was tough on me. I think he was a lot less tough on me than he was on than his dad was on him. But the worst day of my sister's life was one of the many times I got beaten, and I don't remember it. So early on, I learned denial. I turn the fog machines on now, and I just let them roar, and I don't have to see my life. I just see what's comfortable for me to see. And another thing I learned in that house was that I had to earn my love, or I had to earn any love I was going to get. And the message was, it's impossible. You're not going to be able to work hard enough. You'll never be perfect enough to earn my love. That's how I felt from my dad. Now, I didn't get that from my mom, but she was just sort of in the wings of our house. But she turned out to be really strong because my dad got a girlfriend and left. And I remember years later, a kid, an alcoholism related story. His alcoholic dad would beat him when he got drunk, and he'd come to our house. And I remember one time he said to me, "You're so lucky you don't have a dad." I was about like 12, and I remember thinking, that's the weirdest thing anybody's ever said. But I know what he's saying, because he got beat up for like not cleaning up the garage or you know, just crazy things. And I didn't have that problem anymore. My dad was gone. I thought it was a bad thing. And here's somebody saw it as a good thing. So it was my introduction to a new perspective on a problem. So I had these before Al-Anon. And I got this in the sharing. I started to look back because people talked about their lives. Not long ago, this meeting had two meetings in a row. The meeting topic was dads. And they were powerful meetings. So I realized that I was slowly starting to learn that I couldn't blame my wife. And there's a joke that goes along with that. And I can't say it properly, but you just fill in the blanks. And there's a guy, he goes to the psychiatrist, and he sits down, and the psychiatrist says, "How was your week?" And the guy says, it was not bad. He said, "Anything significant happened this week?" He said, "Well, I had a Freudian slip." He said, "You want to tell me about it?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "I was having dinner with my wife, and I meant to say, 'Honey, could you pass the salt?' Instead, I said, 'You effing, you know what? You ruined my life.'" Shouldn't be laughing. It's not funny. It's true. That's how I was. She ruined my life, and I completely believed that. I believed that I had everything down. So I was raised in the San Fernando Valley. You're just kind of a mindless little surfer kid. After my dad left, my mom started going to a psychiatrist, and that was in the early days of psychiatry. And he basically said, "Leave your son alone. He can do anything he wants." And my mom let me do anything I wanted, which meant I didn't have to do everything the other kids were doing. Made me think, do I want to do this? Because I can do it. Do I want to like go to the liquor store and steal candy? I don't need to. I just didn't need to do that stuff. I was the last kid to like do, you know, smoke pot and drink beer. I was the last one because I didn't really need to. So I was really grateful for that. I really needed to be left alone and given the respect. And my friends would ask my mom, "Why do you do that?" And she says, "I married his dad. He's got to have better judgment than I do, because I had terrible judgment." And I remember hearing that going, that's pretty cool. So that was a big reinforcement for me to act right. So I just kind of lived along, little surfer kid, going to the beach, surfing a lot. And that was the only thing I really had, was surfing, and I was pretty good at it because my mom was so cool. She'd take me to the beach on Friday. She'd take me up to the little beach in Ventura and drop me on Friday and pick me up on Sunday. And I just surfed all weekend. Didn't get any trouble. Just had a great time. If there wasn't any surf, we walked around. And I feel good about that, and it kept me out of trouble. And I was really grateful for that. Got out of high school and went to a college at the Canyons up in Santa Clarita. And I met a girl, and she told me that her brothers had been really mean to her, and all she really needed was somebody to love her. Yeah. I was already sick. You know? And that's true. You know, I have to remember that I have a big part in my story. And it's easy. That's the main thing I forget. I forget and I go right to blame that you ruined my life. Actually, the whole rest of the joke is much more appropriate to how I feel most of the time. So I met this girl, and I guess you could say the horns in her head fit the holes in my head. Because we were off and running, you know. I proposed to her. You know, you're what? And but I'm really grateful for that. That means she was pregnant, guys, okay? Jesus. So but I'm really grateful. That was 30 something years ago. It was 33 years ago, 34 years ago, because this October will be our 34th anniversary. We're still married. Thank you. And I have a 30-year-old daughter, and both my kids are awesome. They're not in program yet, but I've learned to keep my mouth shut and try to be an example of this program. And just as a sidebar, about 2 years ago, I was in San Francisco with my son. On a Thursday night, we were going to a concert. He invited me to a concert, and I flew up there, and it was about 5:45. We were riding across one of the bridges, and my phone just started ringing. And it was guys from this meeting saying, "Where are you, man?" And I said, "No, I'm up here with my son. We're hanging out." And I got about 3 or 4 phone calls. And when I hung up, my son said to me, "Dad, you changed so much." And that's a huge thing coming from him, because we don't really talk that way. I've tried to be a really good dad, but those kind of moments are really rare at our house, partly because of this disease. Anyway, I started a business at this time, and it was turned out to be a really successful business, and I was doing well, and we were raising the kids, and you know, we had the nice house and the nice cars, and my son, I got to be the dad that I wanted. And so I at least knew to do the opposite of what he did. I never missed a parent-teacher conference. We rode dirt bikes. We all had dirt bikes. He raced. I had to go to therapy for that, but he raced. And when my daughter, you know, wanted to do something, we got jet skis. We got all the jet skis. We had a motor home. Everything was rocking. We were doing great. But about this time is when really the drinking started. But we had a lot of fun. You know, you go water skiing, you drink a lot. You know, it's a big part of it, you know. I didn't drink when I rode, but we drank all night. You know, you're at the lake, it's 120 at like 8 in the morning, you know. You drink. It's just the way it goes. So the way to say it is we started out drinking and having fun. Then we started out, had fun and problems. Then we just had problems. And along the way, my wife started taking Vicodin, and I had no idea. My denial was like, I didn't see things I should have seen. I didn't want to see them, but I didn't see them. This is when Universal opened, and they had the big theater, but it was before City Walk was in, so it wasn't really much of a hangout. We'd go down to one of those restaurants. The bar bill was always bigger than the dinner bill. And we half the time fought on the way home, really bad fights. I mean, I drank too. I kept up with her, but what I didn't know is she was already a goner when we left to go there. You know, she'd already had plenty of sedatives, you know, before. And on the way home from these, I remember it so well. While we were fighting, I thought she was taking vitamins. right part of the dictionary, but they were called Vicodin. And she wound up taking a lot of those, I guess. On our daughter's 17th birthday, the water skiers were all over. This was in the mid-90s. And we'd had a party for her at home. And putting on that party was just too much. And she had, you know, ate too many of everything. And she was, by the time cake and ice cream rolled around, she was a basket case. And she said, I have a problem. I have a problem with all these things. And I called our therapist. And the therapist said, take her to rehab. So I did that. And the next morning, I took her to detox. And the detox doctor had told me to call this rehab center and ask for, you know, see if there was a place for her. And when I called, the information girl, after she gave me the number, she said, that's a really good place. I went there too. And you know those girls can't say that stuff. And I know that that was God talking to me. I didn't have any God in my life. Up until that point, God, you know, he made sunsets and babies and, you know. But I had no God. God was not in my life. I was my God. If I wanted something to happen, I had to make it happen. And so, but I thought that at that moment. I thought God did that for me. And I took her to this rehab, and it was down in Venice, and we live in Santa Clara. And there was no way I could get there. Getting to family night was really hard. But I did go to the first one where a psychologist told me I had a problem and I had to go to Al-Anon. That's right. Funny girl, because I wasn't going to go. I was perfect. I was working my butt off. I was earning good money. You know, I had a Porsche at the time. You know, I thought I was rocking. I did everything right. How could I possibly have a part in this problem? And so I didn't go. And she went to this rehab. A big moment of clarity for me was taking hair color down there for her and big box of stuff. And they pulled it out of the box and said, you can't have this. And I said, no. And that's what she asked me to bring that to her. And they said, she'll drink it. And I remember thinking, this is more than I bargained for. They were just supposed to fix her and send her home. I didn't know that I was really entering into, like, crazy land, you know? And but she came home. She got a sponsor. She went to meetings. And I just remembered this the other night. She was going to the Rafters. And if you know the Rafters, it's a pretty gnarly place. It's an awesome place. But she got some Harley boots and a leather jacket, and she had a Harley sticker in the back of her car, and it took her an hour and a half to get ready, and she looked like she was going out, you know, with Freewheel and Frank, the biker, you know? So what the heck is this AA place, you know? But anyway, she was sober, you know, and she one time during that time, I tried to pick a fight with her. And I was just trying to push all the buttons that always worked. I think I might have pushed that button even that always worked, as you're just like your mother. And it didn't work. And in fact, she said, I'm not letting you affect my serenity. And that... I was already pissed, but that, like, totally... But at the same time, I respected part of that. A little deep down, I respected what she had. And that was the beginning of me wanting what she had, what she was getting at these meetings. And I had no idea. I had no interest at all. I was working, you know, 60 hours a week. You know, on the week, I'd get the jet skis ready, you know, on like Wednesday so we could leave Friday. You know, I did all that stuff. We also have 14 acres I take care of. I'm a sort of a part-time musician, and I play a lot. So I'm real busy, and I wasn't interested in doing all this stuff. And that's why I didn't go to family night. So, really. But But that was a real huge thing. And it went really, really good for a while. But what I didn't know is during this time she was supposedly sober, she was spending. And my bottom came when she left me the bad news of how much we were in debt, moved in with her brother, who was at the time 25-something years sober, and that was my bottom. And at the same exact time, almost in the same month, my dad, who I had just told I didn't want him in my life, it was just he was too much trouble, he was too hard to be around, and I just had too much baggage with him, he got real sick, and I had to take care of him. And what I didn't know was his house was, he was a pack rat, there's little trails through his house. This was in 2000. I went to one Al-Anon meeting in December of 2000, but he was so sick and so bad, and my life was so crazy with my wife living at her brother's, me having this business. It was just too much. And I was down at my dad's house every day. He was in sales, and I swear to God, I went to the post office a couple of times a week and cleaned out a bin. They just put all his mail in a bin, and it was like Medicare stuff and junk mail. And I filled up my pickup truck, took it home, and sat in the my driveway and threw 99% of it away. But in it was checks and important things. And it was just such an intense time. And in my business, I get to spend time with people, and I get to know people pretty well. And one of my clients had told me that she was an Al-Anon, and she gave me some speaker CDs. Actually, they were something called tapes. But I just say that for you guys just to make it easy. And I started listening to these CDs, tapes. And you know, the thing about them was their lives were much worse than mine. And they were much better off than I was. And I promised my... And one of them was Mary Pearl. And I'll always love Mary Pearl. And I'm still a big CD guy. And at all, one of the meetings I go to in the 8-Way now, I keep a big box of CDs for people to listen to, and I always keep a fresh supply of Mary Pearl, because she managed to talk about this hellacious life with fun, and I really appreciate the fun of what we have. I know I'm not very funny, but I don't part being up here is real serious business for me, and this is. I really respect this disease. I've seen it kick some serious booty, and I don't want to forget that. You know, it's kicked mine. So I went to these meetings, and I started in June. My dad died June 1st, 2001, and I went to the first Monday meeting, the Valencia Beginners meeting. And I never said I was new. So I have such respect for you new people who can say you're new, because I was too arrogant and too scared and too freaked to say I was new. Never did say I was new. I just thought you guys thought I was a cool guy who moved in from out of town, had a lot of years under my belt, you know. And I did a panel last night with a lady who was at my meeting, my first meeting. And I told her that story, and she said, yeah, you were really mad. I didn't fool her either, but I was every negative emotion in the back of the books we do from our reading. Self-pity, you know, anger, confused, you name it, you go through the book. I was every single one of those at a level at 11, you know. But I listened to the sharing, and the sharing blew me away. I just kept going to Monday night. And these people say, well, you know, my boss wanted me to do this, and I really was uncomfortable, and And, you know, I listen, and the next week they go, so I prayed, and I called my sponsor, and I did this, and my boss said, do it however you want. I thought, God, that was a little miracle in that girl's life. That was really cool. Other people were having deaths in the family, and everybody was going to the funeral, and I was going, this is really interesting. These people are amazing. And it took me the longest time to catch on. The amount of love that's here. You know, one of my buddies in this room calls it God with skin. You know, I don't answer my cell phone at work. And when I picked it up just before I came here, there was a whole bunch of calls from guys from this meeting wishing me luck tonight. There isn't a guy in this room who would trade places with me tonight, I don't think. This is a tough place to be, because these Ladies, I wish you could hear the sharing in this meeting, but you never will unless you have an operation, because... because it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. I came to this meeting, and after I'd been coming for a while, and I called my sponsor and said, I want more of what those guys have. This is where I really, really... You know, to have a meeting with the subject is dads. Anyway, I heard the readings, I heard the sharings, and I heard the steps, you know, like for the zillionth time, I thought. And I heard the second step. And I thought, you know what? I can do that. I know I'm powerless. I know I couldn't have stopped this. But I can believe something can help me. And that was the beginning of me having an open mind and starting to listen. I started listening to the steps really more carefully and seeing what was in there. The third step threw me for a loop because I thought, if you can do that, you don't need any other steps. That's it, man. If you can give your life and your will over to the care of God, that's it, man. That's what life's all about. You know, but I didn't realize it was just a decision I was going to have to make over and over on a minute-by-minute basis. And about this time, I realized I needed a sponsor. I did not want to have to ask somebody to be a sponsor because I was afraid I was going to have to be in the position of earning somebody's love that I could never earn, just like my dad. And when I called Jack to be my sponsor, it took me so much courage. And I did it over the phone so he could say no and I wouldn't have to, you know, it'd be a little easier, it'd be safer. And he said he'd be honored. Nobody had ever said they'd be honored to do anything with me up until that point. And that was a huge thing. I'm telling you because I didn't forget it. And so we started working these steps together. And I needed the willingness I got in step three, the open-mindedness I got in step two, and the total disaster that happened in step one for step four. You know, because in step four, I had to put all this stuff on paper and be honest. And my part was pretty shocking. I realized I had good damn reason to blame a bunch of people for how I was. And then I got to that damn column where it was my part, and I realized I had a big part in why I was here. And when I did my fifth step with him, and at the end of that, he said, "Do you notice any pattern in what you just told me?" And I realized there was. I realized it was no self-esteem, insecurity, and ego. Those were the three main ones. And another thing he said, me too. He said, I've done stuff too that I had to share with my sponsor that I'm not proud of. And he shared some of those things with me. So I didn't feel so bad because I was feeling pretty low at that moment. And then we got on our knees, we held hands, and he said, and he taught me the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer. And he said, congratulations, you just did step 4, 5, 6, and 7. So I took a year off. I didn't do any step work, I thought. But instead what had happened is I was humiliated. I was humiliated to think that I had such a big part in my misery. I had no idea. Blaming worked really well for me. And that was getting me ready. That was step 6 and 7 for me. It was that year off, and I didn't know it until recently was thinking about that. Because I needed that humility to be humble enough to sit down and make a list of all the people I'd harmed. And I'd harmed quite a few people. Least of those would be myself. But I wasn't at the top of my list. I've heard people say that. I got to the top of the list after I did the list. But I was not at the top of the list. There were people I'd really wronged. So when I did step 9, my instruction was I had to do every... If I was going to do an amends, I had to go see... I had to meet with him and go through it with him. So I didn't do any more harm, because I could have. Al-Anon was really helping me, and I could have jumped into this and done something too soon and done wrong. And instead, I talked to him, did these amends face-to-face whenever I could, and I did the hardest one first. And I'll never forget, some of you know the speaker, Ajit. He's spoken here. I listened to his speaker CD on the way out to Lake Los Angeles and on the way back when I did my hardest amends, and I did that first. And I didn't realize how much guilt and shame I had until that day. Because it was down in the fog. And I couldn't see it. It was hidden in that soup of you know, what's down inside me that I don't want to look at. And I drove a jet home from Lake Los Angeles that day. I didn't drive my car. I just floated home because it felt so good. So to this day, doing step 10 is easy. Well, not that easy, but it's not super hard. Step 11, I was realizing that I was really much, much different and much better. And that's about that time I think I came to this meeting, and that's when I really wanted more. And I heard the man, and I have so many unbelievable heroes, from the guys who are on their first night can tell us why they're here, which I cannot believe, to the guys who've been coming for years and years and years and keep coming. So in step 12, I realized that a lot of this stuff was working, a lot of the meditation I'd been trying, the spiritual reading, and around that time, somebody asked me to take over a panel at a rehab center, and I still do that to this day. In fact, I took a world service commitment relating to hospitals and institutions, and I believe I'm in over my head with that one, but I'm just following along here, like always. I don't say no anymore. And that's been a huge eye-opening. One of our traditions says to understand the alcoholic, which is pretty damn impossible as far as I'm concerned, but going to these rehab centers is unbelievable. Not too long ago, I was at a rehab center, and we hadn't even started yet, and a little girl leaned next to me who was in the rehab center. She said, "Excuse me, I'm 19, and my 24-year-old sister died a couple of months ago of drugs and alcohol overdose. Does that mean I can't go to Al-Anon?" And she said, "I'm 24 hours sober." She thought because her sister was dead, she didn't qualify anymore. You know, unbelievable stuff. I'm learning a lot about the disease of alcoholism going to these places. I've taken panels to Acton, you know, which is an unbelievable place. Al-Anon panels. Unbelievable place to learn what makes alcoholics tick. And I needed to know this stuff because I was in for New Bottom. God put me through the steps because what had happened, my wife owed me an amends. And she filled it. She did. She filled it. She went to work and she worked hard. She's a real smart girl. She got real good jobs. She earned a lot of money. She grooved on working. We live in Santa Clarita. She worked in Irvine and she was working 100 hours a week. She told me that she was many nights she just stayed at work and just worked the next day. You know, and this was insanity. This was in 2006. She wound up totaling a new car on the way to work. Our son got married during that time, and it was really getting insane at my house. I'd call my sponsor, and he'd say, "There's no indicated action. Keep the focus on yourself. Just, you know, keep going to meetings. Do what you're doing. You know, you're powerless over what she's doing." So I did. You know, keep it light and polite. You know, "How are you today?" You know, it was tough. When my son got married, she missed our 30th anniversary was the night before his rehearsal. She missed that. I went to dinner with my iPod. Wasn't bad, actually. She missed the rehearsal. I had to get one of the teenage kids to be my wife during the rehearsal. She made the rehearsal dinner, thank God. She and my son said to me that night, "I'm afraid." No, he said, "I don't know how to get Mom to the wedding, Dad." And I had an Al-Anon slip because I said, "I'll take care of it, son." And when I left for the wedding in my tuxedo, she was in the shower. And I know how long it takes her to get ready to go somewhere. She wasn't going to make it. And I called everybody I knew. I called my sponsor. I called everybody. Thank God for cell phones, eh? And I called one of my buddies. And he said, "Roger, you've been in boot camp." He said, "Today you're going to war. You're going to need every Al-Anon tool you've got when you get to that wedding." So I walked right up to my son and I said, "Son, I was wrong. I could not get your mom. I was wrong to tell you that I could get her to show up. I couldn't do it. I don't know what's going to happen. Let's have a good day." He said, "All right." And she showed up, and I think God was taking care of her and my son, because knowing the shame I felt from what little things I had done for my, they weren't that bad. compared to missing your son's wedding or something. The shame that she had from what alcoholism had done in her life, and it was her family, is a lot of it in her family. I'm really grateful that she was able to be there for that. She missed their brunch the next day. By this time, she was sort of a joke. People were kind of laughing about her and stuff, and that really hurt me. I didn't want to have to laugh about it, but I kind of laughed with them because there's nothing else I could do. And I was going crazy at this time, really, truly crazy. It made my daughter crazy. My daughter started going to therapy because of this. I have another joke. The joke is, how many Al-Anons does it take to screw in a light bulb? None. You just sit back and wait for the light bulb to screw itself. Very good you didn't laugh very much, because that's not very funny. Because I had to sit back and watch her go down. And that was so hard to do. And I had to see pill bottles on her desk and not look. And I didn't look. I had to see things that she'd written and not look. Because I know people who had looked. And it didn't help them. So this was a really hard time for me. At this time, I'd asked somebody I know who'd been in Al-Anon about 25 years. I said, I'm going crazy. She said, well, I can tell you something that works. It works every time. It takes about 3 weeks. I said, yeah. What is it? And she said, pray for your wife on your knees that she gets everything she wants from her higher power for her highest good. I called her the next day and said, what? She told me again. And I did that, and I still do it. And I didn't know. I don't know if it took 3 weeks. I think it took four. But what it did do was it gave me detachment. Because prior to that, I needed her to be okay. That was part of our marriage. I was stuck in this marriage, and I needed her somehow. I couldn't leave her. And this detached me. We talk about detach with love. This did not feel like it was with love. This felt like indifference. But what I found out later was, I think it was as much as I needed to cut those deep bonds that we had. And it was love for me. Part of that detaching was love is for myself. I didn't realize that. So I was able to detach with love. And one day I was getting ready to go to... I went to the psychologist that told me to go to Al-Anon in the first place, that my daughter was now going to because of the wedding. And I went to her and asked her what I should do, and she said, it's real simple. Do an intervention. Well, I called my sponsor since I got into my car, and he wasn't impressed with that solution. And since I'm a big speaker CD nut, I found out that a lot of the guys that do the interventions are the guys whose speakers, I've heard them speak. So the one guy I really liked, I wanted him to do the intervention that I was planning. I was doing all this footwork. He was pretty expensive. And I mentioned to one of my buddies this, and he's how much it was. And he said, that's interesting. That's exactly how much it cost me to file for divorce. Give me a big hand on that. Good. So I knew how to do footwork now, so I went to a lawyer. And the lawyer said, after we had our meeting, he said, what would it take for this not to happen, this divorce not to happen? And that threw me off. And I said, she would need to go back to AA and to another program. So I called my sponsor again. And he said, you need to tell her. And I said, that's an Al-Anon slip. He said, no, it's not, because you're not telling her. You're not trying to manipulate her. You're telling her the truth. So I told her. And she said, let's work it out. And I didn't call my sponsor because I didn't want to say, okay. I was too mad. I was too beat. I was too done. But I did say, okay. So the same girl that had given me the praying on my knees technique had the same day, interestingly enough, give me the number of a shrink. And he's a man. And she said, I want to go to a shrink. I want to go to a man. So I said, okay. I have one, actually. It's on my desk. So we called this guy. I called this guy. We went to him. And on our first meeting, next to his desk, he had a little stack of something that looked familiar to me. And I asked him about five too many questions. It turned out they were a stack of Al-Anon directories. And he said he'd been in Al-Anon over 30 years. So that was a real God shot for me. We still go to him. And I consider it an Al-Anon slip-free zone. It's his job to correct me, and I let it rip. I say what I want to say, and he corrects me. And I tell my sponsor tells me every time I go to keep an open mind. I don't call him anymore, but I used to call him on the way to every session. He said, keep an open mind. And that's where I realized how, to this teeniest tip of the iceberg, why she drank and why she used. And it's given me compassion for her. And our tradition 5 talks about understanding and encouraging the alcoholic. And encouraging means to fill somebody with an animating enthusiasm, not easy to do, you know, when you're dealing with that. But enlightened polite is the closest I can get sometimes. Sometimes I can be pretty good at it. And to understand it, I can only understand it by sometimes seeing how much pain she's in. And I do love her. And it's really hard. And I think it is going to work out. I'm pretty sure. I'm 100% in my marriage. And that's something else my sponsor tells is I've had a lot of trouble with that because I thought it was a lot easier to be 90% out and 10% in. And that's how I lived for a long time because it was safer. I didn't have to be in. In one of my speaker CDs early on, I heard Dr. Bob's son say, "What's wrong with me that I can't love you?" And that's sort of my encapsulation of Al-Anon. My sponsor said to me one time during this crazy period, I said, "What do I do?" And he said, "Be a loving husband and keep the focus on yourself." So that's what I try to do now. I try to let her be who she is. This morning, we had an argument over what temperature to leave the thermostat at for the housekeeper. Mine was higher, hers was lower. And I realized that I was way madder about giving in to that than I should have been. And she left and I left and between those her leaving and my leaving, I read Courage to Change, and it was about step 7. It was about asking for help. You know, asking for help in your defects. And I realized that I have a problem. You pull one little rock out of the dam of my resentment dam, and they all come out at once. You know, I'm arguing over this damn thing, and I was way too pissed. You know, for what had happened, and she was so worried that I was mad at her. She called me, you know, a couple times from her car, and she was way too mad at me. She was way too worried that I was mad at her. I had to call her to say, "I love you. And I'm sorry that I was that way to you, because it's not right. I don't mean to be that way." And I did say I'm sorry. I know I'm supposed to say I was wrong, but I think I said I'm sorry. But I did try to tell her that was me who was the one who was wrong. And that's what I've learned here. All those things that there's one more thing I want to say before I'm done. Back to the AA literature. And my sponsor is also big on pages. This is on page 90 in 12 and 12. And it says the same thing. It says, whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause is within you. And they're all saying the same thing. You know, what's wrong with me that I can't love you? And that's really tough medicine for me. Because it totally works for me that it's your fault. And it doesn't work for me that it's my fault. So it's 25 after, and I'm done. Thank you, guys.